Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how orange juice and other citrus drinks have been grossly undervalued. Some new research out of the University of Granada in Spain shows they're really powerful. And that's good. Research shows that group walking cuts the risk of threatening conditions out of the University of East Anglia in the United Kingdom. We're going to talk about how pomegranate juice, and of course eating pomegranates, can not just make you healthier, it can add life, days, weeks, months, and years to your lifespan. Brand new information on that. Higher fruit intake and vegetables reduces cardiovascular disease. That's a new study, a major study. Also, birch essential oil is good for arthritis, muscles, and joint pain. We'll give you the latest on that as well. We have a lot to share on health and nutrition, and always some quality research. Then we're going to take a look at many things on the environment, including an interesting article that I read earlier this morning from Jonathan Fay from Associated Press. Do you have any idea how much we burn in the way of gallons of gasoline in the United States or around the world? If you think you know, call 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and then I'm going to tell you about how much we use and how much there is to use and why we should really be getting away from all this. Then we hear about we need the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We need the North Atlantic Partnership to increase jobs, to have more manufacturing. Just the opposite is true. We need to approve the Keystone XL pipeline because it'll give, quote, jobs creation bill. Again, it's not true. But what they're not telling you is that solar is creating jobs nearly 20 times faster than overall U.S. economy. So if we want to put people to work and save money on our utility bills and clean up the environment, solar is the answer. Also, don't buy the hype. We've been told about free trade from Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan and Bush and Obama. It's all lies, pathological lies. We'll give you the truth about free trade and how it's not free. Plus, my guest in the second part of our program is Professor Janice Vilhauer. She is Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Emory University School of Medicine. And we're going to talk about how to get past being held in the past, confronting our fears and anxieties of the future, and becoming more conscious of our lives ahead. I think most people will be able to benefit from that. If time permits today, a commentary on, are all terrorists Muslims? No, not even close. From the Daily Beast, Dean Obadiah, you'll be amazed at how few terrorists are actually Muslim. In fact, less than 2%. Well, who are the other 98%? Why don't we ever hear about them? You will today. Most people have known that if you drink a glass of orange juice, you'll get anywhere from 40 to 60 milligrams of vitamin C. That's not a lot. It's not the vitamin C, but the other phytonutrients and antioxidants that are important. Most people don't know what's in grapefruit juice, that lemon juice is bitter, but there are hundreds of different chemicals, naturally occurring chemicals, healthy chemicals, per fruit. The trouble is, we have been undervaluing it. According to brand new research out of the University of Granada, using a new technique, they are able to measure the property and it generates its value. And they say that it's 1,000% more than what any of the current analysis have been able to show. So orange juice and juices from other citrus are much healthier and are higher in antioxidants, which reduce free radicals. Remember, when, let's say you have a glass of juice and you drink it. Normally, if there's no other food in your stomach, it'll go into your stomach, out of the stomach, through a little flap called the pyloric sphincter and a muscle. Then it goes into the duodenum. Then it goes into the intestine. It's absorbed. The whole process might take 10 minutes, very quick, or even shorter. And then it goes to your cells. But when it's from citrus, which is loaded with antioxidants, each of those antioxidants are able to trap free radicals. And free radicals are what damage your cells and cause inflammation and cause DNA mutations, cause cancer. So the more antioxidants that you have in your body at any given time, the longer you're going to live, the healthier you're going to be, and the less disease from free radicals and pro-inflammatory agents you're going to have. And that's why I believe we should start our day with antioxidants, have the most antioxidants after our exercise, because as good as exercise is and it's great for you, it also creates free radicals, lots of them. So you need your vitamin C and vitamin E and coenzyme Q10 after you work out. Then four other times in the day, and most importantly, before you go to bed at night. Because while you're sleeping, your body's in a catabolic state and it's breaking down and detoxifying and repairing the damage done during the day. That process creates free radicals. So if you have your vitamin C at night, you're trapping free radicals overnight. Also, most people are not aware of this. Lots of heart attacks and strokes occur in the middle of the night. So if you have taken your vitamin C and vitamin E before you go to bed, and it's in your blood, you're less likely to have a heart attack because your blood is going to be thinner, and the platelets won't be aggregating as if you had a meal and went to bed, or you had some fat and went to bed. Then you're just really playing Russian roulette, because all that fat before you go to bed, like a pizza at night, a milkshake at night, means that your blood is going to be very thick. In fact, once I wanted to show a class this, and I took a group of people, and I had them take a blood. We had a nurse take blood, and then we showed them the blood, and you can see the blood under a microscope, and you suddenly see it's kind of dark. But then when you start giving them antioxidants, especially ones like trimethylglycine, vitamin B12, vitamin C, the blood gets lighter and lighter. And what you want is you want pink blood. You want real red blood. You don't want dark blood. Dark blood shows that it is lacking the oxygen. So, and then hyperbaric oxygen really oxygenates your blood. That's as good as it can get. And that helps you with all forms of cancers. Remember, the higher the oxygen in the body, the less cancer is able to proliferate. And this has been supported repeatedly in tests. In any case, when you have orange juice, grapefruit juice, lemon juice, lime juice, some combination, and other fruits as well, watermelon juice, you're trapping the free radicals, you're oxygenating the blood, and you're causing a spacing of the blood cells so they don't clump together, what's called aggregation. And that's what causes a clot. And that's why taking your antioxidants, not just in the morning, but throughout the day, then your body 24/7 has protection in it. And that's especially true overnight. So when we showed blood after a meal, and we told them, go out and have any meal you want. And they had their meals, came back, took another sample of blood an hour later, and it looked like streaks of white, and that was the fatty acids. That's the fat, the arachidonic fats from cheeseburgers and hamburgers and grilled cheese sandwiches. Not good. But when they had a healthy vegan lunch, the blood did not have those streaks. It was not cloudy. You don't want cloudy blood. You don't want white blood streaks. You don't want your cells clumping. That creates a heart attack or stroke. Now, if you have onion, you have garlic, you have watercress and kale, you help prevent a heart attack and stroke. So the latest news out of Spain is, have your orange juice, grapefruit juice. It's 1,000% healthier in its antioxidant capacity than what we've been led to believe. Also, walking is so important. First of all, it's low impact, so you don't really risk injury. According to a new article in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, people who regularly walk in groups have lower blood pressure, lower resting heart rates, and lower total cholesterol. That also leads to a lower body fat, or what's called the body mass index, which means body fat. And you really need to be doing at least minimum 30 minutes of moderate physical activity every day. And most people don't. So it's important that you do. And that's what they found. So walking together with some other people makes all the difference in the world. So power walking, live a longer life. There are over 3,000 studies on the fruit pomegranate. And pomegranate is what is called a superfood. It's better than the other fruits, at least most of the other fruits. But now a new study has come out at the Foundation for Revitalization, and it's a university, also a transdisciplinary university in India. And what they found is that pomegranate juice is not just good in vitamins and antioxidants, but also it can add years to your life. Now, this is important. The study found that fruit flies fed with pomegranate juice not only live longer, but also are resistant to some diseases and produce more offspring. Very important. So you can say that there is valid scientific evidence that pomegranate has rejuvenative qualities, improving quality of life and delaying aging. My suggestion is that you have pomegranate juice or pomegranate powder or pomegranate fruit each day. Makes a big difference. In fact, the fruit flies were able to live 19% longer, and that's a big deal. Now, that gets to the larger issue about Americans don't eat organic fruits and vegetables enough. It's growing. There's more and more people are becoming aware of it. And more educated people are likely to consume a quality of fruit and vegetable and more of them. This is from a major scientific study out of Japan. Quote, Japanese researchers have found that higher total intake of fruit and vegetables was significantly associated with reduced risk of cardiovascular disease death in Japan. And that was published in the peer-reviewed journal, European Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Quote, we examined associations with the fruit and vegetable intake with death risk from total cardiovascular disease, stroke, and coronary heart disease in a representative Japanese sampling. And how long did they do the research? 24 years, 9,112 participants. So that's a good quality study. I know that many people wouldn't think about eating fruits and vegetables, don't always get around to it. And just put time on your side, help your heart, prevent cancer, have your fruits and vegetables. And by the way, a good juice to start the day with in the morning is tomato juice, because with tomato you can add in raw onion, raw garlic, little tiny bit of horseradish, mustard seed, cayenne pepper. You blend that around. If you have high blood pressure, You have elevated cholesterol. You have elevated homocysteine, fibrinogen, C-reactive protein. It helps bring all of those down and protects you from a heart attack or stroke. So for people who've had a heart attack or stroke, this is a natural heart booster. And it's a good way of getting your lycopene and other important nutrients for your immune system and your eyes. So for those of you who've been using your green vegetables powders and your red powders, once again, you're way ahead of the curve and you're doing the right thing. Just a major study proving it. For those of you who have had muscle aches and pains and joint pain, some good news about another thing that helps. And this is birch, B-I-R-C-H, essential oil. It comes from birch, a tree bark. And it sometimes you can purchase it as sweet birch oil. The pure, unadulterated birch oil is not expensive. And what makes it special is that 100% pure birch essential oil contains both the methyl salicylates, which are very important for turning off pain. They have cortisone-like qualities that reduce discomfort in the muscles, bones, and joints. And they're also germicidal and bactericidal. So, whereas birch essential oil is an effective antispasmodic, an anti-inflammatory, an antiseptic, an anti-disinfectant, it is a pro-stringent and diuretic. It really shines, and it's used to combat muscle and joint pain. And you can get it, put it on your joints, tendons, put it on where you have gout, put it on where you have severe muscle cramping. So you don't need much of it to make a difference. In fact, another oil that I think people should have would be geranium oil and also lemongrass oil. By the way, lemongrass oils, like lemongrass tea, is one of the finest teas you can have. I blend two teas together. I use lemongrass and red zinger, and then put in, well, you bring your water up to a boil, turn the water off, let your tea steep, and then when it's cooled down, you add in your Manuka honey, and then you drink that. That is great for this time of year. So that helps you from the inside, and the birch oil helps you from the outside. Between 2 to 6 drops would make a difference on the skin. I'm Gary Noll. We're here to help people live a longer and healthier life. And one of the ways that we can do this is by stopping the heavy metals that get into our system. And the heavy metals accumulate, and they accumulate in human tissue. And the toxic levels of iron and leads to neurologic disease like Parkinson's. But just think of all the metals that we never were told about, cadmium and the arsenical compounds and the metalloids, and they damage your DNA. And that means you're at an increased risk of cancer and what is called genotoxicity. And we wake up one day and you're having headache, you're forgetting, you don't have the energy you once had. Well, you could be suffering from neurodegenerative disease. And that includes ALS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, Huntington's, all in earlier stages before they've been fully diagnosed. No one's going to check you for aluminum or beryllium, cadmium, mercury, lead. So have a heavy metal check done at least once a year. Now, once you have that, you'll see, okay, you have these. What do you do? Well, you've got to give up the type of things like cooking with aluminum, using aluminum-based deodorants, get the mercury out of your mouth, get rid of the silver fillings. Holistic dentists will do that because all these accelerate the aging process. You don't want anything that's going to put more heavy metals into your body. And by the way, heavy metals can also cause rheumatoid arthritis, birth defects, bleeding gums, constipation, diabetes, dizziness, fatigue, emotional problems, headaches, heart damage, hepatitis, high blood pressure, hyperactivity, infections, irritability, and joint pain. So get the heavy metals out. Now, the best way of getting them out, of course, is with chelation therapy, but a lot of people can't afford it. So lemon juice with wheatgrass, 1 ounce, 2 ounces of wheatgrass with some lemon water. That's one way. Green apples with celery and cucumber juice, a 16-ounce glass. That's another way. You really want to step it up. Chlorella and spirulina in your green powders. That really chelates out. All good. That's our health and nutrition segment. Now for some things on the environment. Those who have looked at the issues oppose the Keystone XL pipeline. Now that Congress has a majority in the House and Senate that want to support it, it's a matter of trying to reach enough Americans to let them know that this is not going to be a job creator. In fact, last year, jobs in solar increased 21%. There were 31,000 new jobs, bringing the total of solar-related jobs in the United States to 173,800. That's an 86% increase since 2010. And these are good-paying jobs. So we should be putting the energy and interest and finances into solar, not on a very polluting oil that is destroying the Canadian environment. And right now, the neo-fascists control the Canadian government. And that oil is going to be taken across the United States right through some of the most pristine environments and water and aquifers, including the Algolago Aquifer, the largest one in the United States, right down to Texas where it will be refined and then shipped to China. China will then pay Canada. So let me see. It's made in Canada, brought through the United States, processed, exported to China, but the money goes back to Canada. How exactly does that help us? It doesn't. At what risk does it place on us for problems? Enormous. But we could be having made in the USA solar, used in the USA. Could you imagine how much pollution we would stop? How much energy we would save? How much people's utility bills would be reduced if they were using in warm states? Solar, even in other states where you have part of the year where you have adequate sunlight, you could be saving lots of money, even in Maine and New Hampshire, Vermont, New York. My home is 100% solar. It even heats a swimming pool completely. In fact, whatever the ambient air, solar automatically kicks in and makes it 10 degrees warmer. It can run water pumps from your own wells. So that way you're off the grid. So I just want to share that with you. And also, we have been lied to so many times by people in government. Let me explain how it works in the overview. You wonder, how does anyone in power get so much money when they're out of power? It's because when they're in power, they were selected before they were elected, knowing who they have to see is not prosecuted or what laws have to be amended or changed or written to protect the interests of certain large groups, not individual companies, but whole industries. My feeling is that President Obama will become the wealthiest president in American history. Right now, that honor goes to Bill Clinton, who has made over $100 million. Now, his foundation has made hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's because, why? All the favors he did when he got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act. So there's plausible deniability. No one's going to put on a computer, Bill Clinton, if you pass this law and put all of our people in head of the Treasury and head of the Federal Reserve and all important oversights in the stock exchange, we will see when you're out of office that you'll come be able to give a 45-minute lecture on nothing relevant that we haven't heard, and we're going to give you $500,000. and you can do it 5 times a year. Oh, and we're going to have you sit on 35 boards. Each time, each board will give you $500,000 a year, and it'll take no more than 2 days of your work per year per board. Oh, and we're going to donate to your foundation. Oh, and we're going to have our private jets take you any place in the world you want. Oh, and you'll be able to use all of our corporate retreats, and we'll work it so it seems like it's a conference on poverty or Save the Haitians. That's how the game is played with every president. So Barack Obama has done more for corporate America than Bill Clinton. He is the most pro-corporate president in American history, even more than George Bush. So I would imagine within 4 years after getting out of office, he will be loaded with huge honorariums. He'll probably be the first person to get a $1 million honorarium. I think George Bush Sr. got $1 million for showing up in Kuwait, but that will be the new norm. And when you say, why would anyone pay that amount of money? Because it's called the 1-to-1,000 factor. For every dollar that you give to someone, you get $1,000 in return to the benefit of your business. So that's why they give these amount of money. So then these people go forth out of foundations and think tanks, and they're all coming from the point of view of privatization, free trade. They're all saying the same things. But they're all lies. These are very sick people. These are psychopaths, sociopaths. The entire industry is. Hundreds of thousands of these people reside in the cesspool called Washington, D.C. It's overflowing. And no one will pull the plunger and flush this crap away and get some legitimately decent human ethical people in their place. So now they're trying to sell us on the free trade agreements. Understand something about these free trade agreements like NAFTA, CAFTA. There's nothing free about them. They do not create jobs. They kill jobs. They do not help reestablish a quality of life. They depreciate it. So President Obama is expected to push for fast tracking for the corporate-friendly Trans-Pacific Partnership. My hope is that people in this audience across America will let their legislators know, no to fast tracking, no to these treaties. We don't need these treaties. These are not treaties that benefit us. They will destroy our unions. They will destroy our natural resources. We will never be able to ban anything again. And they will not be able to be rescinded. And by the way, if you doubt me, remember Obama fast-tracked the agreement with Korea and the U.S. trade deficit with Korea jumped to 50%. 50%, that means that 50,000 American jobs were lost since he signed that treaty. We have a $3 billion, with a B, monthly trade deficit with Korea, and it's the highest monthly U.S. goods trade deficit with the country on record. So how did that work for us? All the promises, they were all lies. It does not work for us. It works for them. In a moment, we're going to come back with my guest. Before we do, let me give you an idea of some of the themes and guests coming up on our next 4 shows. We have on our next program Professor James Kilroy from the University of Illinois, speaking on U.S. prison system and racism behind incarceration. Then we have Don Paley, a Canadian scholar and investigative journalist on the capitalist agenda behind the war on drugs. And he has written the most exhaustive study and research to date on the collusion between the U.S. government, transnational corporations, militant groups, drug countries, drug cartels, and the media in keeping the war on drugs endless within a deeper capitalist agenda. The next day, we have on our Progressive Commentary Hour, we have Dr. Tony Bark, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Brian Hooker, John Gilmore, all talking about what we know about the pro-vaccine assault on those that would challenge the legitimacy of vaccines. Then the next day we have Dr. Dale Archer, and on the current epidemic of heroin use, primarily among younger, educated, professional whites and the privileged class. So we have a lot of interesting topics, discussions coming up. Back in a moment with our guests. Please stay with us. Everyone, I'm Gary Nall. We're broadcasting all over the world, and I just received a note from our program director in New York who said that he was thanking all the hosts who said that we had 290 million visits in the last 12 months, and my program had over 100,000 downloads each week. Those are people go to the archives. That's not listening live on our satellite stations and our support stations. That's just downloading it. The average age is 34. Educated college graduate women interested in progressive themes, listening at night after work. So we have a pretty good profile of who's listening, the issues they're interested in, and we thank them for their support. In a moment, we're going to go to Professor Janice Vilhauer. I gave you her background earlier and her research in integration and mindfulness methods and what is called future-directed therapy, a new form of psychotherapy developed by her for treating depression and other psychological conditions. And earlier, she was director of Cedars-Sinai Medical Center's Adult Outpatient Clinic in Los Angeles and a clinical professor at UCLA. She graduated from Fordham and UCLA and completed her doctorate at Columbia University. And her new book is Think Forward to Thrive, How to Use the Mind's Power of Anticipation to Transcend Your Past and Transform Your Life. And we'll go to her in just a moment. But no one called in, seeing if you could guess how many gallons of oil that we burn. Well, it's 2.7 million gallons of oil that we burn per minute. Now, according to Associated Press, that's a whole lot of oil, and yet the price of a barrel of oil has fallen by more than half over the past 6 months because of the politics and also because of abundant supply and not enough demand. If we continue to support solar and wind and geothermal and wave, we will even reduce the demand for oil. Here's the good news for all of us who've been protesting and marching and championing anti-fracking and anti-coal, that for the greater glut of their products on the market, the dropping in price means at a certain point they're not able to make a profit. It costs $65 to produce, ready for sale, a light crude or heavy barrel of oil. They're now selling at $44. They're losing money. So all over the American continent, especially up in Montana and Wyoming, down in Texas, the oil rigs are closing. Now, that's not good for the highly paid, generally over $100,000 a year, people working in the industry, and they're $200,000 in the industry. But it is good for the environment, and is also good for those of us who don't want to see hydrofracking, which pollutes the water, pollutes the ground, pollutes the air, kills the animals, sickens the people, and they have no legal consequences because they manage to manipulate the politics within the states through ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, representing some 300 major corporations, including the energy cartels, so that they don't have to tell you what's in their chemicals that they're putting in and all the water they're extracting, even in states that are suffering from severe drought, where people are rationing water, such as in California and in Texas. They are not limited in the amount of water they're taking out. That is unfair. So if they're closing down shop, good. The people are going to be hurt are the speculators, and these are the parasites of society. They do not benefit us. I will give you a greater input upon how much oil we use and how much we're not using today, and therefore why the prices are lower and how they're going to even go lower than what they are. By the way, to give you some idea of how much fossil fuel we've been burning, just in the last 35 years, we have burned 40 trillion gallons. That's a lot of pollutants to put into the air. So, more on that on an upcoming program. Let's now go over and say hello to my guest. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here.
There was a Swiss mathematician and physicist, Leonhard Euler, who wrote, "The pull of the future is greater than the push from the past." And yet for the vast majority of people, there is security found in relishing the past rather than letting go and surrendering ourselves to the process that pull us into the future successfully and joyfully. And the future is going to pull us forward whether we like it or not, and it's our struggles with facing that future positively that so often brings suffering and anxiety and fear and negative mental disturbances, especially if we have grown up at any point where we have been traumatized by abandonment or insecurity, lack of confidence in self. So I'd like you to begin and take your time to first outline how and why our fears of the future incapacitate us and serve as a barrier preventing us from achieving our goals and a greater sense of purpose and fulfillment in our lives. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you. I'll do my best to sort of answer that question. It's a very big question, but essentially the future plays a very, very big role in, you know, our emotional well-being in the present because, you know, as you were sort of at, to, you know, requote what you were saying, the future really does pull us and, you know, it's how we're thinking of the future. If we think of it in a positive way, it's going to elicit positive emotion in the present. If we think of it, obviously, in a negative way, if we're worried about the things that are going to happen to us, that's going to elicit a negative emotion in the sort of present moment. Now, to answer the question of why so many people have, you know, difficulty thinking of the future in a positive way, it does have a lot to do with what we call our memory, that in fact, you know, when things have happened to us in the past, we remember them, and when they're negative things, that those memories tend to stand out even more saliently. And we use our memory to then project into the future what we think is going to occur. And as a result of that, we oftentimes get trapped in this process of recreating the past over and over again because we act according to what we expect in life, not necessarily what we want. So even if we want something different, we want to change, that's not really what our actions are going to lead to. We're constantly acting based on what we expect, and that is often drawn from past experiences. So what future-directed therapy does is it really tries to teach people to become very, very conscious of this process, to recognize what they're doing in the present so that they can begin to make some changes, so that they can begin to realize that they don't just have to pull from past memories, that they can be conscious and recognize that, you know, nothing yet has happened in the future. They can choose to think differently about it. They can choose to take different actions. And as they make those different choices, it begins to produce a different emotion in their present moment experience.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. You mentioned fear. Was it not John Berryman who said we must travel in the direction of our fear? And yet as a society, we preoccupy ourselves by distracting ourselves from our fear. We hide it. We avoid it. We sublimate against it. And then that also creates anger, because what we can't control, what we're feeling overwhelmingly, is we cannot adjust or transcend the circumstances we find ourselves in. And it was Montaigne, one of my favorite philosophers, said, "There is no passion so much transports the sincerity of judgment as doth anger." So we are a society that is steeped in anger and frequently confused about our contempt and of what we could not resolve from the past. We walk around with these conversations in our head all the time. The arguments we didn't win or we shouldn't have had. The people who affected us in ways that we were not happy about. And now that time has passed. So speak on the role of imagination and visioning plays in creating a positive future for ourselves, because otherwise that future doesn't exist unless we apply our imaginations diligently to fashion or construct a potential positive future to aim for. We're just stuck in the quagmire of doubt, uncertainty, insecurity, anger, and pain.
Well, that's exactly right. It's essential that if you want to change your life in any way, you have to be able to imagine something better for yourself, because that becomes the target destination that you then work towards. And what I say about emotion is it plays a very, very important role in being able to create your future, because it's telling you something very important. And as you said, a lot of people, especially when it's a negative emotion, will try to avoid the emotion. They'll try to ignore it. They'll try to find ways to cover it up, whether, you know, you generally with an unhealthy behavior of some sort. And what I try to encourage people to really do in future-directed therapy is to really notice your emotions. Your emotions are giving you direct feedback about your environment, about how you're thinking of the future. And as you notice it, you can then make choices about your thought process. So, you know, if somebody's having that feeling of fear or anger as they're thinking about something that they're expecting, you know, in the future, an upcoming, you know, event, maybe it's a wedding they're going to, and they're upset about the idea of seeing, you know, relatives that perhaps have treated them badly in the past, you know, it's noticing what the emotion is telling them about what they're thinking, what they're expecting, and then making a conscious decision to decide, do I want to continue to hold on to that thought process, knowing that I'm likely to then sort of act in a way that just kind of exacerbates the situation, or for, you know, at the least, I'm not going to be doing anything different to change it. Or can I begin to sort of use that emotion to indicate to me, okay, I don't like what I'm expecting. This is my moment of opportunity to really consciously choose to change my thought process, to change my expectations about that situation, and to really, you know, instead of dreading what's coming, perhaps create a plan for how can I make this go better for myself. And so to use the information, or use emotions as information that is really kind of providing you with data, so that you can then begin to make changes based on the information you're getting.
That gives us a little better focus on this issue. But what are some of the major obstacles we must be conscious of in our application of the imagination? And I ask you this because a study commissioned to the Princeton Survey Research Association looking at how people feel about their chances for becoming rich found that more than half, about 55% of young adults between 18 and 39 believe they would become rich someday. Only a very small percentage of that number will actually become wealthy. And I have little doubt that among those, many are already entitled to wealth in their families, their heir babies. then as we follow the passage of time and aging, as people get older with greater life experiences and more realism sets in, this percentage decreases dramatically. So do these findings highlight a problem for people holding unrealistic imagination about their future? And what is the difference between healthy and unrealistic and unhealthy daydreaming and musings about our future?
Well, what we really try to get people to do is to, you know, be sort of be more informed, be more aware. You know, one of the processes that we go through with future-directed therapy is learning how to, you know, assess, you know, what's happening, to take in data, to make rational decisions and choices about things. So, you know, there's a real sort of process that people have to go through. You know, the general sort of public has what we call a positivity bias. You know, most people think they're going to, you know, be rich, or most people think they're better than average, which, you know, statistically can't be true. So, you know, and part of that is something that, you know, I think inherently we all have sort of as a way to kind of boost our self-esteem and to kind of keep us, you know, feeling good throughout life. And, you know, as you said, as we get older, we learn more, we have more information, we become, you know, somewhat more realistic about our goals. But, you know, it's really about, you know, learning to do things in a sort of rational and effective way. And, you know, one of the things that we do to facilitate that process is we get people away from simply just sort of daydreaming or imagining a positive future, but really, you know, identifying specific goals and then really identifying, you know, what are the realistic obstacles that they're going to face as they come up against those goals. There's a lot of research that shows that, you know, achievement is tied to the ability to be able to identify what the obstacles are and then develop a plan to get around those obstacles. You know, so you really need two plans in life when you're creating your future. You need a plan for where you're trying to go. You need a plan for how you're going to get around the obstacles that are likely to arise. And it's in that process of identifying obstacles that people make much more realistic assessments about things.
Then work off that notion a little further, please. Because after, as you said, we become clear about our goals for a positive future we wish to strive for, then what are the following steps your research has shown to reach them? And how important is the role of taking time each day to meditate or practice mindfulness in this process?
Well, there are, you know, a number of steps that people need to go. You know, I always say, once you've identified something you want, which for a lot of people is a whole process they have to go through just to get to that point, but then you have to sort of, you know, really assess, what is it I want? What are the goals I need to, you know, how do I build a specific plan? As I said earlier, how do I identify the obstacles to get to that plan? How do I then utilize, you know, my sort of thought process and my resources, my actions and my behavior? So it's a whole sort of process. You know, how do I engage, you know, the visualization process, you know, using that part of the mind as well to sort of facilitate, you know, more mental capacity that moves us towards goals. So there's a lot of, you know, different steps that I sort of outline in the book that tries to sort of walk people through this process in a very step-by-step way. What you brought up, which is the concept of mindfulness, is one of the very important steps, because in mindfulness, this is something that people ask me all the time, you know, how can I be mindful and be in the present moment and still create my future experience? And what I try to explain to people is that mindfulness is about conscious awareness. It's not about a time frame. So I think people get confused. They oftentimes think that in order to be mindful, they have to, you know, only think about the present moment. But you can mindfully and consciously think about the past, the present, or the future. And if you want to create change in your life, it is essential that you think in a conscious way about the future. And that's one of the things I really try to highlight in this book, because so much of the time we're just kind of operating on default mode, as I said earlier, recreating the past over and over again without much awareness. And so mindfulness gives us this conscious moment or window of opportunity when we can begin to choose differently, when we begin to slow down and see the automatic process and instead make a different choice about it. So that's really where the mindfulness practice comes in. You know, it's my belief that people need to engage in, you know, some kind of activity like this, you know, at least 10 to 15 minutes a day to really get a benefit. And I know that sounds like a lot, but sometimes you can just find, you know, moments. It doesn't have to necessarily all be consecutive, but, you know, you can find a few minutes in the morning, a few minutes maybe when you get in your car before you start it. You know, just moments where you're really calming yourself down and tuning in to sort of that conscious present moment sort of awareness, so that you can then know what you're thinking and make, you know, give yourself more opportunities to make better choices.
Okay. I have just but one last question for you. And since we're discussing fears and anxieties, people might have towards confronting the challenges of the future, I'd like to take this opportunity to address a particular form of fear and anxiety that I witness becoming epidemic around the nation at this time. Now, it's not a personal expression of anxiety, as it were, but more a collective fear, filled with uncertainty and largely mirroring a future world that is becoming more and more insecure. And I observe this to particularly common groups such as young adults. It's hard to imagine that setting high goals for the future, for example, to achieve a particular career or job, will be met when there are so few quality jobs available, unless you're very specialized, like a medical doctor or a technician or an engineer, an architect. Yes, there are jobs for those people. But if you're the average college student today, no. You're more 55% are going to graduate and not have a job, but they'll have debt, and the debt will be compounded, and their parents or grandparents will be co-signing on the debts. And if they don't pay it, then their wages can be garnished, and there's debtor's prison. So that's something that we did not have in the past. So personal debt is now endemic. And when wages are flat, they're busting unions. And I don't meet the cost of living if I'm an average person. Most young adults I meet feel convinced they will never own their own home. Not that that is a bad thing. I believe with the future we have to think minimal and not believe that having a car, a house, and debt is the responsible thing to do. I believe we have to have a whole new mindset. And there's a great deal of anxiety and fear about the future of the environment, of climate change, the future of food security. So I don't believe it is sufficient to say that we can be successful creating our futures if our anticipation of the future is nothing more than a reflection of images from the past. So I would say that a certain amount of creativity, innovation, and realistic critical thinking is also necessary for people to be successful in their envisioning a positive future. Your final thoughts on this, please.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we know is that, you know, the solution, or I should say the problems that we encounter in life, whether it's individually or globally as a society, that they give birth to the solutions. And, you know, every generation has struggled with many, you know, different kinds of problems, but it's, if you think of the future in a negative way and you believe that nothing can be done about it, then that dramatically increases the chances that you will do nothing about it. But it's the people that are able to remain sort of positive about their ability to make change and be creative and improve circumstances where you start to see, you know, as you said, that creative thought process giving birth to new solutions, you know. And that's what we need our young people to be doing. We need them to be thinking in a different way than, you know, the generations that kind of got them into this mess, you know. We need them to be creative and to, you know, learn to see the problems and to develop some of the solutions. And, you know, I have great faith that they will, because I think generations before have always done the same.
Well, thank you very much for your work, including Think Forward to Thrive. I appreciate you being on today.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. It was a pleasure to be here.
Professor Janice Vilhauer, Vilhauer. I want to close out today's program with an abbreviated look at Are All Terrorists Muslims? It's not even close, according to Dean Obadallah from Daily Beast. Quote, what percentage of terror attacks in the United States and Europe are committed by Muslims? Guess. Well, we've heard this over and over. Not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslim. Wrong. We've heard that from Brian Kilmeade, who says it all the time on Fox. And the so-called terrorism expert, Steve Emerson, was caught fabricating the story that Birmingham, England, is closed to non-Muslims. But more alarmingly, even some reasonable people have uttered this statement. And that comment is often followed by the question, why don't we see Christian, Buddhist, and Jewish terrorists? Obviously, there are people who sincerely view themselves as Muslims who have committed horrible acts in the name of Islam. And Muslims can make the case that their actions are not based on any part of the faith, but on their own political agenda. But they are Muslims, no denying that. However, and this will probably be shock to many, overwhelmingly, those who've committed terrorist attacks in the United States and Europe aren't Muslims. They're not. So here are some statistics for those who are interested. Let's start with Europe. Want to guess what percent of the terrorist attacks that were committed by Muslims over the past 5 years? 2%. As Europol, the European Union's law enforcement agency, noted in its report released last year, the vast majority of terror attacks in Europe were perpetrated by separatist groups. For example, in 2013, there were 152 terrorist attacks in Europe. Only two of them, two out of 152, were religiously motivated. 84 were predicated upon ethno-nationalistic or separatist beliefs. Now, we're talking about groups like France's FLNC, which advocates an independent nation for the island of Croatia. In December 2013, the FLNC terrorists carried out simultaneous rocket attacks against police stations in two French cities. And in Greece in 2013, the left-wing militant Popular Revolutionary Forces shot and killed two members of the right-wing political party Golden Dawn. While over in Italy, the anarchist group FAI engaged in numerous terrorist attacks, including sending a bomb to a journalist. And the list goes on. Have you heard of these incidents? Probably not. But if Muslims had committed them, do you think our media wouldn't have covered it? Even after one of the worst terror attacks ever in Europe in 2011, when the 77 people were slaughtered in Norway to further an anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, pro-Christian Europe agenda by the person who perpetrated it, how much press did we see in the United States? Yes, it was covered, but not the way we see when a Muslim terrorist is involved. Plus, we didn't see terrorism experts fill the cable news sphere asking how we can stop future Christian terrorists. In fact, even the suggestion that he was a Christian terrorist was met with outrage by many, including Fox's Bill O'Reilly. Have you heard about the Buddhist terrorist? Well, extreme Buddhists have killed many Muslim civilians in Burma, and just a few months ago in Sri Lanka. Some went on a violent rampage, burning down Muslim homes and businesses and slaughtering four Muslims. Or what about the Jewish terrorist? Per the 2013 State Department's report on terrorism, there were 399 acts of terror committed by Israeli settlers in what are known as price tag attacks. These Jewish terrorists attacked Palestinian civilians, causing physical injuries, 93 of them, and also vandalizing stores or mosques and Christian churches. But in the United States, the percentage of terror attacks committed by Muslims is almost as minuscule as Europe. An FBI study looking at terrorism committed on U.S. soil between 1980 and 2005 found 94% of the terrorist attacks were committed by non-Muslims. In actuality, 42% of terror attacks were carried out by Latino-related groups, followed by 24% perpetrated by extreme left-wing actors. So, before you believe the people who want to condemn all terrorists as being Muslims, look at the facts. Maybe you might want to send that article, which I'm posting, over to Bill Maher. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Now let's say hello to you, Therese Lead. Hi, you, Therese.
Hi, Gary. Today it's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, and listeners have their say.
Right now, you, Therese Lead.